Good morning, everyone. I'm Steve Heidemann, the Vice President of Grant and Fellowships Program at the USIP and also a special advisor to the Institute's Muslim World Initiative. We are still absent one of our panelists, Jeffrey Lewis, but given the wealth of expertise that we have assembled for you today, we thought it would be worthwhile getting our panel launched on time just to make sure that we have ample opportunity not only for our panelists to offer their contributions, but for an exchange and interaction with the audience. So as soon as Jeff arrives, he'll be able to join us on the panel. Before we begin, I wanted to let you know that we have made some copies. I don't know if we have enough for everyone, but we've made some copies of the National Intelligence Estimate on Iran, on nuclear intentions and capabilities available. There are also, those copies are available on the table outside. There are also some additional materials from the Institute and from some of our panelists on topics relating to the theme of this morning's panel, and we would encourage you to take advantage of those and pick them up on your way out as well. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Thanks as well to all of our panelists for taking the time to be with us. And let me, in addition, before we begin, extend a special thanks to USIP Senior Fellow this year, Professor Avner Cohen, who is really the moving force behind the organization of this panel. It is not often that USIP fellows take the initiative and put together activities like this. And as one of the people who typically has responsibility for doing so, I'm always grateful when one of our fellows takes that particular piece of our workload off our shoulders. So thank you very much, Avner, for that. We have, as I said, put together quite an extraordinary group of specialists this morning. I'm not sure I can recall an event in which we've had quite this breadth of expertise represented at a single session. And so I do not want to take a great deal of time this morning introducing the topic of the panel. But just by way of a very brief introduction, Jeff has just joined us. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the National Intelligence Estimate that is dated November 2007, but which was released in early December of 2007, the NIE that argued that Iran has suspended its efforts to develop nuclear weapons, has really been, I think, almost unprecedented in the level of controversy following its release. I think it's had policy implications that are in some respects no less far-reaching in terms of their impact on policy debate than the 2002 National Intelligence Estimate confirming, to the best of the intelligence community's ability, that Saddam Hussein did in fact possess weapons of mass destruction, and we all know what followed from that. The 2007 NIE of December has deepened tensions between the White House and the intelligence community. It has provoked still unresolved conflicts between the intelligence community and the Israeli government and intelligence community about Iran's nuclear capabilities and nuclear intentions. It has led one domestic critic of the report, who shall go unnamed, as suggesting that the NIE was nothing less than an attempted bureaucratic putsch aiming to tie the hands of the Bush administration in a way that had very troubling implications in terms of policy formation by the executive branch. And it was characterized by its supporters as a signal effort to protect the country from reckless adventurism by dangerous ideologues. So I don't think we can underestimate the extent to which this NIE has been both controversial and influential, and its effects continue to echo throughout the policy system. But I think perhaps more than any of these reactions that I've just referred to, the NIE also raised very important questions, and I think largely neglected questions, both about the NIE process itself on one hand, and about the relationship between a document like the National Intelligence Estimate and the process of national security policymaking on the other hand. And it's really these issues, these questions, that we want to use this panel to try and address and engage this morning. This is something of an unusual format for us. This is a format that we are calling a roundtable, one that is intended to not only collect a broad range of perspective and opinion, but to facilitate debate, constructive debate and exchange, both among the participants in the roundtable and between the roundtable and members of the audience. And so for that reason, we are operating on the basis of a somewhat unusual format. We will invite each of the members of the roundtable, whom I'll introduce in a moment, introduce briefly. There should be more, there should be longer bios for all of the speakers available for you outside in the hallway. I'll introduce them only briefly. Each of them will have 7 minutes, no more, up to 7 minutes to lay out an initial set of observations. When that is complete, we'll invite very brief exchanges among members of the roundtable to respond to one another. And at that point, I hope we will have at least 45 minutes left for questions and conversation debate between members of the roundtable and the audience. With one exception, I would like Avner, as the originator of this panel, to start off, but otherwise we will proceed in the order in which people are listed in the announcement about the roundtable. And I'm very pleased to have with us and thank all of them for their participation, Dr. William Burr, senior analyst of the National Security Archive, which is housed at George Washington University, Dr. Avner Cohn, who, as I mentioned, is a senior fellow of the Jennings Randolph's Fellowship Program here at the U.S. Institute of Peace this academic year, Dr. David Kay, senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies and former IAEA UNSCOM chief nuclear weapons inspector, Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, director of Nuclear Strategy and Nonproliferation Initiative at the New America Foundation, Dr. George Perkovich, vice president for studies in the field of global security and economic development at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Dr. Paul Pillar, associate professor of Georgetown University and former national intelligence officer for the Near East and South Asia at the CIA, and Leonard Spector, the director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, which is attached to the Monterey Institute of International Studies. And so with those very brief introductions, let me invite Avner now to take the microphone and to get us launched on our roundtable this morning. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve. I would start with adding to what Steve just had said about the uniqueness and the provenance of this document, the recent NIE about Iran. By the way, we're all talking about perhaps 2% of the entire documents, probably there are hundreds of it, which most of us, I assume, in this room did not read, and we're talking about only this 2%, which has become so controversial, which is the public declassified version. So everything I'm referring to, the NIE, obviously I'm referring to these 2.5 pages plus a little bit of notations around it. Well, there are levels of paradox about this document. On one level, it is difficult to think about a document, single intelligence document, that stirs so much domestic and international controversy and attention. And at the same time, at least in my humble opinion, was written, conceptually speaking, in a sloppy and a misleading way. So that's one level, this paradox between the attention and a certain aspect of sloppiness, which in a moment I saw what I mean by that. On another level, it was a document that symbolized, it was a call for independence of the intelligence community, in many ways, a desire to free itself from any political influence. And at the same time, this document, whether politically or not, it's a different story, it is fundamentally biased. Again, I will explain that in a second. So there are layers of paradox about it. The moment it came out in this early December of last year. Steve and I were talking about it, and I felt immediately this tension between, on the one hand, the importance of the document, and at the same time, the fact that the document is so problematic, and the idea of having something, discussion about it, was born around that. I felt that perhaps we cannot contribute much to the actual findings of the documents. After all, those findings are classified, and we cannot add that much to that realm. But our experience from academia, in terms of methodology, in terms of history of proliferation, we can contribute a great deal of something of our own insight to add to this discussion. My own personal background, on the one hand philosophy, at the same time history and nuclear proliferation, particularly the Israeli case, provide me the two poles of my own critique of these documents. Well, at the heart of my critique is the first sentence and the first footnotes of these documents. The first sentence says, we judge with high confidence that in the fall of 2003, Tehran altered its nuclear weapons program. And then the footnotes attached explain that, quote, for the purpose of this estimate by nuclear weapons program, we mean Iran nuclear weapons design and weaponization work and covert uranium conversion-related uranium-related work. We do not mean Iran's declared civil work related to uranium conversion and enrichment. Now, this first sentence and this footnote, I think, are highly, highly problematic from the very beginning. Even if the classified raw data at the core of this finding is accurate, credible, and consistent with some situation on the ground, again, it's a big if, and one needs to provide some interpretation of what it means, but presume that's the case. I would argue that the way that the NIE conceptualize, package, and sells this finding through this terminology is at best sloppy and confusing, and its words is deliberately biased and misleading. To put it a little differently, one can argue that the author of the declassified finding failed either to grasp the phenomenon of nuclear proliferation, or what is important, what is less important about proliferation, how do we measure proliferation, what do we seek in terms of indication of proliferation, or they have a certain kind of agenda. Neither interpretation is not very complimentary. I can also mention that as a teacher, if a student of mine would use that kind of terminology, I would feel myself failing, and not providing the students a good grasp of the field, because this is a wrong way to conceptualize the field. Let me explain why. One way to highlight the problematic nature of the NIE starts, and the definition of the nuclear weapons program lies with the strict separation it requires between nuclear weapons program and declared civil work, leaving the impression as if the latter has nothing to do, conceptually speaking, with nuclear weapons program. And this is, of course, nonsense. I would make the point by two famous citations by two great minds of the nuclear age. One of them is Professor Ernst Bergman, who was the founder of Israel's nuclear program. And he used to say, various kind of occasions, there is no two nuclear energies, one for weapons and one for peace. But rather, there is one nuclear energy that could be used both for good and for evil. Similarly, Professor Hannes Alfvén, the Swedish Nobel laureate, in 1977, in a speech to the conference on peaceful uses of the atom, he used to say, atom for peace and atom for war are Siamese twin. Now, their point is simple and well taken and known from the very beginning, from the very dawn of the nuclear age. There is a great deal of overlapping in how we master the atom for both good and evil. And the major issue is, of course, the nuclear fuel cycles and the production of fission material. That's a major aspect, whether we go for weapons or whether we go for peaceful civil declared areas. The fact that the authors do make the separations and do not take it into account as a major aspect, major component, is highly, highly problematic. Of course, they know it. And nevertheless, and they do mention that by between 2010-2015, Iran is expected to have the options, but nevertheless, they insist on a most narrow definition of nuclear weapons program. Now, unlike the author of this NIE, students of scholars have known that all along that the most important aspect is the enrichment or plutonium production, the issue of fission materials. I can say very briefly that in my own study of Israel, I can say that Israel was more or less, in 1964-65, was where Iran was in today. That is to say, Israel had the Dimona reactor just running, producing plutonium. The outside world did not know that actually Israel had the reprocessing plant. And of course, the weaponization was something very, very obscure, and the outside world knew very little about it. In fact, it was a complete different, separate branch. Now, what it shows that weaponization is a small part, small component, which very often its importance comes in the very late stages. And the most important hurdle is the issue of the fission material productions. And if you look, you have to look first not at the obscure area, but rather at the open area. I want to end with very quick three observations, three conclusions. First on history, nuclear weapon programs tend to function, especially prior to the advent of the bomb, not as a well-defined bureaucratic empirical entity like the NIE tried to suggest, but rather much more like a campaign, election campaign, before the candidate actually announced anything. So there is all kinds of activities. There is a feeling that we are organizing something that's going to have a mission, and yet the mission has not been declared. There is no yet any cohesive things. All the pundits show that there is something going on, and yet the candidates can deny it. So I think it's much more easy to compare it to election campaign rather than to a box nuclear weapons program. Second, the most important visible indicator in assessing country place on the proliferation ladder remains the ability and motivation to produce weapons-grade fission material. And thirdly, and the last, the set of activities, limited activities, associated with weaponization per se, is the most obscure, the most elusive, and in any case, it's a small component within the overall activities that we call nuclear weapons program. To call this a nuclear weapon program, it's a mistake, and it's misleading. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Abdu, for organizing the panel. I'm going to give some historical background. I'm not going to talk about Iran. I'm just giving some general background on the problem of NIEs. Before the invention of the NIE, detecting and estimating the purpose, estimating the progress of the nuclear programs of adversaries and allies had become a key activity for U.S. intelligence and a great challenge. When those programs are secret, when they operate in closed societies like the former Soviet Union, discovering them and estimating their development is most difficult, and the possibility of failure is always present. When Moscow tested its first atomic bomb in 1949, Washington was shocked by the speed with which the Soviets had developed the weapon. Unaware of Soviet espionage gains, misjudging Soviet uranium supplies, and underrating Soviet scientific and technological progress, both the U.S. and British intelligence had assumed that Moscow was not likely to test a weapon until the early 1950s, if then. The flawed estimates were a major intelligence failure. This is not a complete disaster because Washington and London had made good use of complex technological systems to detect JO-1, as they called it, and to announce it to the world, but also to learn that Moscow had developed a plutonium weapon. These systems were used in the years ahead to monitor Soviet nuclear activities as well as other national nuclear programs. And the information gleaned from them would support a new type of intelligence product, national intelligence estimates, which first appeared in 1950. Designed to give policymakers authoritative appraisals and interpretations of key issues, NIEs were prepared by the Office of National Estimates at CIA headquarters and vetted by the U.S. Intelligence Board to assure that they represented all views and included dissents when they arose. Always classified, often at very high levels, some NIEs were produced routinely, while others were prepared on request, for example, from the DCI or senior State Department officials. NIEs prepared during a crisis or unusual circumstances were called Special National Intelligence Estimates, or SNEs. Because these were estimates, the analysts could only use their best judgment when there was no solid evidence, and this was often the case when assessing tough targets. Not surprisingly, the NIEs were controversial when intelligence organizations disagreed over the nature of reality in the Soviet Union or elsewhere. A famous example is the missile gap controversy around 1960. Now, around the same time as the missile gap controversy, the intelligence establishment had become more and more concerned about the so-called nth country problem, the prospect that one country or more would develop nuclear weapons, thus showing the UK, the US, and the Soviet Union as nuclear powers. The intelligence agencies began to produce on a more or less annual basis NIEs on the possible spread of nuclear weapons capabilities. These early estimates have been declassified in varying degrees, and they show a careful effort to determine the scope and implications of the problem, to look at each country that was a possible proliferant that was developing nuclear weapons nuclear capabilities, and determine whether the nuclear power could be used to produce weapons in those countries, and whether they had the intention to produce weapons or not. So they wanted to look at the implications of the problem as well, and what might check further proliferation, whether international agreements might check proliferation in the future. The quality of intelligence used in the NIEs varied, but sometimes the best the agencies had was not good enough. As Abner has shown on Israel, U.S. intelligence was behind the curve on the Israeli program for some years. It did not learn until 1960 that Israel had decided to build the bomb 3 years earlier. China was another tough target, but intelligence was better than it had been on the Soviet Union before Zhou won in 1949. While analysts predicted Beijing's first test, the Chinese program produced surprises, such as the use of highly enriched uranium in the first device, but also the speed with which China developed a thermonuclear weapon. Intelligence on Indian capabilities was good, but the NIEs could only make guesses about when India might conduct its first nuclear test. During the Nixon administration, the production of NIEs on the general problem of nuclear proliferation appears to have stopped, although special estimates on India and Taiwan appeared. This pattern, the non-appearances of general estimates of the proliferation problem, reflects the lower priority that proliferation had as a policy concern during the Nixon administration. It was not until August 1974 that a comprehensive special national intelligence estimate on proliferation threats appeared. This is the one that received a lot of press attention earlier this month when the CIA posted it on its website. As some of you may have seen, it provided extensive coverage of many countries, some of it on target, some of it not. Now, the scheme was prepared as a result of an intelligence failure that increased official apprehension about the spread of nuclear weapons. The Indian nuclear explosion of May 1974 startled authorities in Washington, who saw the lack of warning as a serious failure of proliferation intelligence. A postmortem of the failure found that proliferation needed to have greater priority. Moreover, satellite and human intelligence had not been exploited adequately. Despite the findings of the postmortem, the collection analysis of proliferation intelligence remained fragmented and uncoordinated. For example, the year before the Indian test, the DCI had abolished the Office of National Estimates and put NIE production in the hands of National Intelligence Officers, NIOs, with responsibilities for geographic areas and functional issues. But no NIO had responsibility for nuclear proliferation intelligence. It was not until 1978 that the DCI corrected this problem after taking other measures to provide better coordination of proliferation intelligence. That same year, senior managers at CIA looked closely at the problem. One of them, the deputy director for science technology, observed that the community had a long way to go before it established a well-focused nuclear proliferation collection program with clearly defined roles for each agency, a role for NSA, for CIA, DIA, in assessing nuclear proliferation. The deputy director also saw overall inertia in community mechanisms for applying resources to particular problems. Now, whether creating an NIO to manage proliferation intelligence helped overcome some of the organizational inertia would be a good topic for a study. Certainly it would be a difficult one to research. Although much has been learned about nuclear intelligence since the 1970s, the NIEs and other documents remain highly classified. We're not likely to see them for some years. We know that the new NIO system had successes in proliferation intelligence, but it also met controversial failures. And concern about politicization of intelligence has grown in recent years, as we've seen. Now, we're now in a political environment where it's become possible to read the classified conclusions of a major nuclear NIE that would have been unthinkable 20 or 30 years ago. Now, this is an unusual development, but I'll leave it to my colleagues here to explain, to continue discussing how this came about and what it might mean. Thank you.
Thanks very much, David.
Thank you very much, and Abner, my congratulations for the role you played in organizing this. Let me begin, much the way Abner began, by saying I have not read the full NIV. And if any comments I have are totally related to the unclassified version. That puts me in an awkward situation because I judge the unclassified version to look like it was written by a really very inadequately trained graduate student. And I hesitate to jump on it, although if there were any of my former graduate students in the room, they would say it never stopped me in the past from jumping on their papers. It really does look like something was almost an afterthought. You assign someone, take this rather long report and make a synopsis of it. Anyone's ever prepared a synopsis knows that's often more difficult than writing the book to get the full content. But let me say a few things about the unclassified report, because I think it causes me great pause to the extent that it represents, and that's the most we can say about it, it may represent what is in the classified version. First of all, let me echo strongly what Abner said with regard to the first paragraph and the failure to understand that a civil program and a military program are one and the same in terms of the science, in terms of very much of the work. It's not just the enrichment, by the way. It's the criticality assessments that you have to do on a civilian nuclear reactor. Even worse if you have a research reactor using HEU, very similar to the calculations you run on a weapon. There's something in the NIE that in the first paragraph of the unclassified version I really don't understand. Let me quote it. We mean Iran's nuclear weapons design and weaponization work and covert uranium conversion-related and uranium enrichment-related work. This is, to my knowledge, the first time the intelligence community has said that it had proof that there was a clandestine uranium conversion and uranium enrichment program. Indeed, if this had just come out, as we have found there was, that would have been the lead in every newspaper and TV and radio report around. That is startling news. Now, I don't know whether it's because they have new evidence that existed or someone was simply trying to define what they thought a covert program might be. And that's terribly important. It's largely been missed in the public commentary of this. Secondly, there is something that is unfortunately, and I bear the burden of knowing all too much about the Iraqi NIE, there is something that is generic to many NIEs, those I have had the opportunity to read the classified version of, and that is the tremendous drive for compromise to broaden the support for it. And let me give you an example of this one that is really disturbing. If you skip down about three paragraphs, you discover this amazing sentence. We judge with high confidence that the halt lasted at least several years, then brackets. Because intelligence gaps discussed elsewhere in this estimate, however, DOE, Department of Energy, and the NIC, the National Intelligence Council, assessed with only moderate confidence that the halt of those activities represented a halt to Iran's entire nuclear weapons program. It has nothing to do with whether it continued. It's whether the initial halt in the first sentence, in fact, was their entire program. Now, how did that happen? It's almost the Walpole effect, I would call it, but that's too much of an inside joke. That is what happens when you, in order to get someone on board, you say, well, we'll stick a sentence in that represents your, but they stick it in at the wrong point. This is generic to many NIEs and what I think is wrong. And that gives me an opportunity. Let me switch. Really, it is very tempting to continue with a line-by-line dissertation on the unclassified version because it is open. In summary, let me just say, I suspect that if this represents an accurate view of what the classified version, it will not be many years that we judge this NIE to be as wrong as the Iraqi NIE. But let me say some things about the generic NIE process. And, you know, I really appreciate very much Bill Burr's going through the historic process. The basic problem for me with NIEs is there is no identifiable responsible individual who you can say this represents their judgment of the data. It fundamentally echoes a flaw in the intelligence process itself. No one is responsible. Who was responsible? Name me individuals responsible for the conclusion with regard to the aluminum tubes or the curveball in the Iraqi process. No, it's the intelligence community that failed. The cost you pay for something in which the failure is general and shared and not individual and identifiable is that no everyone can walk away saying, well, I did the best I can. It represents the overall views of it. It really represents the view of no one. I actually think we would be far better going back to an earlier time in which the NIE represents the views of an identifiable national intelligence officer. And we stick there so that someone is responsible. Secondly, in compromise on judgments, which I've already said is general, the differences tend to be narrowed in NIEs to small and actually what become marginalized points, and the support for the overall judgment goes ahead, even though that may not be the intention. It's the nature of the bureaucratic compromise process. I also, and this may be unpopular with a number of people in the room, I actually believe that we would be better off not having unclassified versions, but having a classified version. The greatest difficulty with this and in form of its presentation is it muddled right into the middle of a policy debate. And it muddled with intelligence that sometimes is not intelligence. For example, to go back, I cannot let go of the unclassified version. Tehran's decision to halt its nuclear weapons program suggests it is less determined to develop nuclear weapons than we've been judging. Our assessment that the program probably was halted primarily in response to international pressure. Now, is that based on intelligence or is that based on just general wisdom and knowledge? For which one might say policymakers as well have a very good reason to make those sorts of judgments. Now, if it took place in a classified environment, that is a free-for-all and a battle they could have. It's almost impossible to take a fair view of a classified document of something like the Iran nuclear program and put it out and not affect the policy debate and consequently become drawn into it. And I think this demonstrates, even for the authors, it is hard not to write it with the knowledge of what impact you will have on the policy debate and decide to do it in this case. And finally, I just will conclude by acknowledging you're at greatest risk in doing intelligence, in my experience, when you're coming from a major error or a major victory. In the case of the major error, it was having been raw, and, you know, someone introduced me as I'm an expert on intelligence failures, having participated in so many. In 1991, when I went into Iraq, the community had judged that Saddam didn't have a nuclear program. We found a very advanced nuclear program. In 2003, it was just the opposite. But you're also very vulnerable when you've had a major victory. And I would say, and maybe Abner will agree, that if you look back at the Israeli raid on Osirak, the Israelis overdrew the conclusion of what they had accomplished and believed that they had stopped the Iraqi program for decades. And in fact, they had only made it harder to detect, actually. Okay. So there is a huge problem here. I think, in fact, the people writing this were in large measure trying to correct a past failure. And because it was public, that plays into a policy debate in a way that I find unseemly and not very useful.
Thank you very much. Jeff Lewis?
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here and, frankly, an honor to be on a panel with so many people that I've admired since the very beginning of my career. I was very happy when Abner asked me to talk about the NIE process with a special emphasis on China, which has been my typical area of interest. We have a reasonable insight into the history of U.S. intelligence estimates on China, and that makes it an interesting discussion. It's also interesting because in the 1960s, China was Iran. China was the power that we weren't entirely convinced that we could live with having nuclear weapons, that seemed headed in that direction that provoked discussions about what we should do and whether we should consider a military strike. And so it's a very interesting and analogous case. In terms of looking back, we've got 71 declassified national intelligence estimates that run from 1948 to 1976, many of which concern China's strategic programs. And we can see a number of trends in those analyses, which I think continue to the present day. We have some hint of that because a significant amount of U.S. intelligence estimates on China in the 1990s and early 2000s were leaked, whether they were leaked over debates about allegations of Chinese espionage or debates about the ABM treaty or debates about the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It's really somewhat shocking and distressing how much of that information found its way into public sources. And the other thing, of course, is I think it's interesting because it does inform how we look at this Iran NIE. I wanted to make a few brief observations about the history of those Chinese NIEs, and I had divided that into what I'm calling the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good in terms of those intelligence estimates is that they got basically the big stuff right. They knew that China was working on a bomb. They knew the USSR was providing, at least for a while, assistance. And they identified all the major facilities that were involved in the nuclear weapons program before those facilities became operational. They also identified the test site and saw the Chinese stand up the test tower. The bad was they didn't have any, the U.S. intelligence community didn't seem to have any insight into the Chinese leadership, and so there was no understanding of the bureaucratic, organizational kinds of concerns. And there was misidentification of several facilities. The gaseous diffusion plant at Lanzhou was judged to be not operational when, in fact, it was producing the highly enriched uranium that would be used in China's first bomb, and a fuel fabrication plant was misidentified as a plutonium production reactor. Perhaps this sort of most dramatically came together when the intelligence community was judging that China was did not have the fissile material in order to build a bomb because they'd misidentified the facilities, but they saw them erect the test site, and they weren't entirely sure what to make of this. They posited that there was some Chinese lack of coordination, and in August 1964, National Intelligence Estimate, they said they would defer fuller discussion until August 1964, which, of course, by then, the Chinese had actually tested their device. The ugly is, I think, a consistent failure that runs through those NIEs and probably extends to some extent today. And that's a general assumption that the Chinese nuclear program would look like ours. And that accounts for the misidentification of the facilities. Essentially what happened is the U.S. intelligence community decided that since we built a plutonium bomb, the Chinese would do that first. And so they looked and looked and looked for a plutonium reactor until they found one, even though it wasn't one. And then when they saw the test site go up and they concluded that they didn't have plutonium, they decided to blame the French, at least internally. The French must have clandestinely because it's not possible. The other thing is that there was a consistent overestimate of the number of strategic forces that the Chinese would build, and that was based very much on looking at our own requirements, our own sense, if we were the Chinese, what would we want, and not an understanding of the purposes and bureaucratic interests that drove Chinese decision-making. And I should say that most of the dissents tended to go on the high side. So if anything, the consensus process was dragging the numbers down, which they were still wrong, but they were less wrong than they might have been if, say, the Office of Naval Intelligence had had its way. I say all of that to say that, overall, I actually judge the NIEs to be pretty good. One of the things that drives me nuts is this assumption on the part of policymakers that they have some right to perfect intelligence, that in a complex and challenging world that some 35-year-old person is going to come along and explain it to them, and so that they don't have any responsibility. And that to me is an unreasonable demand put on the intelligence community. It seems to me that the technical assessments of the U.S. intelligence community on the Chinese program were quite good. They weren't perfect, but they were, even 30 years later looking at them, they hold up. Where they were less good were the things that I would count in the category of unknowables. The discussion of the motives of Chinese leaders, which Chinese leaders didn't always share with one another, or future plans, which were in many cases decisions that the Chinese leadership had not made. Looking forward to Iran, I would note two important differences which bring me to this discussion of the Iran NIE. The first is that today we have much better technical means than we did when we began assessing the Chinese program. U-2 overflights were just starting in China. Eventually we would get satellites. And one can see in the intelligence estimates a real increase in quality as better information becomes available. And obviously today we have a tremendous amount of signals intelligence and other sort of electronic eavesdropping equipment that should be helpful. And the second thing is Chinese leaders were making their decisions in a very different cost environment. And this, I think, is extremely important. It was easy to judge the Chinese were building a bomb because they told everyone they were building a bomb. There was no diplomatic coalition to stop them. There was no treaty that said they shouldn't. And to the extent that we were attempting to organize efforts to discourage proliferation, they were clearly on the other side of that. Iran today is in a very different situation. And I'm going to make a brief stab at defending the NIE because I think that the way it's been reported in the press is not quite right. I won't defend the way it's written because I think, as other people have pointed out, it's not written all that well, and perhaps more important, I don't think it was written in a way that anticipated the public debate that would come forward. The way that I read the NIE is that it suggests that the Iranian government is sensitive to costs, and David Kaye mentioned this peculiar sentence. When in the fall of 2003, Hassan Rouhani was appointed basically to be in charge of all of the discussions of the Iranian nuclear program with the West and was given internal bureaucratic control. And he sort of outlined this in a couple of interviews. And at the time, Paul Kerr, who's now at the Congressional Research Service, and I speculated that maybe that signals a sort of bureaucratic reorganization that might signal willingness to deal. And what I read the NIE broadly as is confirming that. So when I read this definition of what the covert work was, I view it as a sort of ad hoc definition of the things that kind of got shut down when Rouhani, over the course of 2003, as Rouhani sort of found himself in a position of authority. And that would be the P2 program that they planned on keeping secret, the site at Lafsanjan Shan, which they bulldozed, all of the stuff on this so-called laptop of death, which included some uranium conversion stuff. And so, for me, what is important about the NIE is it highlights the sensitivity to cost, which the folks working on the NIEs with China didn't have to do. The second thing, and this comes out not in the NIE, but in the press reports, is the role of technical intelligence. I mean, it seems from the press reporting that what happened was there were intercepts of people associated with these various programs, I think the IAEA referred to as administrative interconnections. And it was those people who were essentially grousing about what they were doing. So about the program being shut down. So although I don't think the NIE is written particularly well, it seems to me to make a rather neat package if one asks this question of are Iranian officials sensitive to costs? And in this case, it seems to me that Rouhani did exactly what a tough-minded negotiator who was interested in getting some deal would do. He presumably shut down the most egregious parts of the program, but he continued the civilian program, which both retains options for Iranian leaders and probably provided some degree of domestic cover at home. Now, as I say, I don't think U.S. leaders have a right to perfect intelligence, and so I think the sensible thing to do at this point, given that set of information and that hypothesis, is to design a policy that allows us to test it.
Thank you very much. George, I know that you have a commitment that will require you to leave at 11, so let me take the opportunity before you slip away to say thank you again for your participation on the panel, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'm sorry to speak and run. I want to pick up a little bit where Jeffrey left off and then kind of shift at least my focus. I think it's hard for anybody in this field to read the summary and feel like it's an artfully done piece of work, but I think, and we don't need to rehash that, but I think the basic conclusion makes sense. And as I had a weird experience when I read it, I said, wait, I've written this. And so I went back and I looked and I found a document that I think's out there that I published in May 2005 suggesting that the intelligence community be tasked to assess whether in late 2003 Iran stopped would have been illegal work on nuclear weapon activities. And the reason for that was I spent time in Iran and talked to Rouhani and Rafsanjani and others. But the main reason for it was that a suspension or stopping of activities that violate the letter of the NPT and are clearly nuclear weapons-related activities, if you stop that and revert to activities that are strictly within the letter of the NPT, which includes the ongoing enrichment process, which the NIE acknowledges is still continuing, if you do that, that's the best strategy for Iran. That's the smartest way that they could acquire a capability, an option, to have nuclear weapons. Not a nuclear weapon per se, but an option, which is all they felt they needed. And if you pursue that strategy of staying within the letter, it puts the United States in the worst position. And that the Iranian kind of strategy, the strategic imperative that the leader and Rafsanjani and others felt, was that they were in a contest between Iran and the United States over whom could isolate whom. And that if Iran went back to the letter of their requirements, they had a chance of kind of writing out the international mobilization that was going against them. And I think that's what they've done subsequently. I have the benefit of no intelligence, perhaps in both sense of the word, but certainly in the literal, the legal sense of the word. And so I may be wrong, but I found the NIE interesting on this point. In any case, I think it does little good to argue about the specifics of the NIE, because the reality is it is now a force, a fact of international political life. And so in the work that I do and others in this room do, which is trying to affect policy, try to affect action, including Iran's, it's out. The NIE's out, and it ain't coming back. It's not going to be reinterpreted internationally. Its effect is there. And so I would ask, where does it leave us? Where does it leave the United States? Where does it leave the UN Security Council? Insofar as enrichment is the most strategically problematic activity in Iran, and it's ongoing. So whatever you say about how you define a weapons program and so on, fine. Enrichment's ongoing. We still have the problem, therefore, where does it leave us? And it seems to me where we are is that Mohammed El-Baradei, the Director General of the IAEA, truly holds the key to how this is going to turn out and whether there's a chance that the Security Council, it's not just a U.S. demand, the Security Council demand that Iran at least temporarily suspend its enrichment and other fuel cycle-related activities will ever be implemented. The call for Iran to change its nuclear behavior and limit its activities is key. And if Mohammed El-Baradei, in investigating the past record, what happened before, and clearing up kind of either the ambiguities, the uncertainties, the problems related to Iran's noncompliant activity, if he finally closes the book on that, as he is intimating will be done shortly, and says basically we've answered all the questions about Iran's outstanding noncompliance. There are a couple of things maybe we'll never be able to answer, but we kind of judge they're not disastrous. If that happens, I think game over. I think it's going to be very, very difficult as a matter of political reality to then mobilize not just Russia and China, but the other states on the Security Council, India, Brazil, other important actors in the international community. It would be very, very difficult to mobilize them for another round of sanctions, for a further kind of effort to isolate and squeeze Iran on a nuclear program that the Nobel Peace Prize winning Director General of the IAEA says has basically been kind of cleaned up. And so that's the strategic challenge going forward. And there's a little bit of an irony there in the sense that the NIE, if El-Baradei's kind of resistance to the U.S. and reluctance to really dig as deeply as he could, and I would argue should, into Iran's program. Some of that reluctance was he was worried there was going to be a war, that the U.S. was going to go to war. He didn't want to give more kind of evidence or excuse for that, and therefore he was doing certain things. The NIE takes war off the table, I would argue, so it should have freed him up to investigate much more rigorously, let's say, and vigorously in Iran, and he doesn't seem to have pursued that. So there are people within the Safeguards Bureau at the IAEA, there are other observers who think there's not being enough push and not digging enough and not trying to identify some of the indications the U.S. is referring to before 2003 and going into Iran and say, okay, what really happened here? What was going on here? And so that's kind of a paradox that should have been reduced by the NIE. So if Abarde is key, then the last point to me is, what does the Security Council do? We have these resolutions that are there that require suspension and so forth. But if the momentum, if the power is taken out of those resolutions, what do you do? It starts to look like Resolution 242 on you know, kind of Israel and occupied territories in the Middle East. It's been there forever. People talk about it. The Palestinians talk about it, understandably, and nothing happens. So for the Security Council, there comes a point where you have to say, what do we do for credibility, for ongoing relations with Iran, if kind of the power is taken out of this strategy because of the NIE and Obaride signing off? I don't have an answer to that question, but I reluctantly pose it, and I'll stop there.
Thank you very much,
Paul.
Good morning. The immediate reaction to the release of the unclassified document we're discussing mistakenly portrayed this estimate as a major reversal of previous judgments, and I have a hard time thinking of a better example of an overplaying, including by our mainstream press, of supposed changes in such an assessment. It's important to remember just what hasn't changed, or to point out what hasn't changed in the judgment of the U.S. intelligence community on this topic. Number one, the Iran is continuing its program of uranium enrichment, which, for all the reasons that Admiral Cohen mentioned, is the most important element, the pacing element, in determining when Iran can fabricate a nuclear weapon. Secondly, and stemming from the first point, that the projected time frame for when it most likely will have that capability is unchanged, basically the early to mid part of the next decade. Third, that Iranian officials have, to put it gently, not been truthful in asserting that their interest in a nuclear program is solely for peaceful purposes. There have been and continue to be ample indications of their interest in at least a capability to build nuclear weapons. And fourth, that whether or not Tehran exercises the option to build a nuclear weapon will depend on Iranian decisions yet to be taken, which in turn will depend on the Iranian perceptions of the costs, risks, threats, and opportunities that they face in the year ahead. All of that is unchanged. It's what the intelligence community was judging a couple of years ago. It's what it judges as reflected in this estimate. What apparently did change, we can infer from this unclassified release, is the acquisition of some additional new information with regard to clandestine weapons design or weaponization work, both with regard to what had been going on before 2003 and with regard to the reported suspension of at least some of this work in 2003. And based further on the unclassified judgments, and with the caveat that was included in it that David Kay pointed out, there apparently is still some uncertainty and some disagreement among agencies as to exactly what was suspended, or at least how firmly one can assess it was suspended. The last previous national intelligence estimate on this subject in 2005, which was referenced quite prominently in this unclassified release last month, made no judgment about the status of a clandestine military weapons program. There simply was not enough information to make a judgment one way or another. So if the finding in this new document that got the biggest headlines, that is to say the one about suspension of a military program in 2003, supposedly was the reversal of a previous judgment, one will search in vain for the judgment that was supposedly reversed. It just wasn't there. Given that there has not been a fundamental change in the most important intelligence judgments on this subject, neither is there change in the basic policy questions of how to deal with the Iranian nuclear problem. And these include, but are certainly not limited to, the question of what combination of carrots and sticks, of threats and engagement, would be most likely to induce Iranian leaders not to exercise that option of making nuclear weapons. Well, of course, what logically should be the impact on policy discussion, and what I just said basically seconds what the president has said, that the basic policy challenge hasn't changed, is not, of course, the same as real political impact. And, of course, as George pointed out, this has had the, number one, the impact of taking the military option off the table. Number two, it has undoubtedly complicated the tasks of getting additional sanctions, although this most recent agreement reached by the Perm 5 in Germany for at least a mild new sanctions resolution indicates it's not totally impossible. And third, there are various other effects on the Iranians themselves and how they might behave that could be a matter of debate. There are several aspects of how the intelligence community presented its judgments in this case that have contributed to the misperception of big change. One is certain aspects of wording of that old estimate in 2005, in particular the unfortunate choice of the word determined as part of a judgment to try to describe what Iranian intentions were. That's the sort of word that people focus on, and they just kind of delete the rest of the judgment. In this case, the rest of the judgment talked about determined under then current circumstances. And, oh, by the way, they're not immovable. They might change their mind, which is kind of another way of saying they aren't really so determined. And I think the intelligence community can be criticized for what it put out a couple of years ago for producing an oxymoronic sentence. But even more so is how the latest estimate has been worded and structured, and that's really been covered thoroughly by the previous panelists. The use of the term nuclear weapons program to describe only the military weaponization part, the way the whole thing's structured to emphasize what has changed and not what has continued. And then the one other thing I would add is that matrix that was added at the end, which is labeled key differences with previous judgments, and there are a couple of basic problems with that. One is it's not just key differences, it's key similarities, which in this case are at least as important. And secondly, the matrix compares apples and oranges in some cases, you know, lining up a judgment about intentions versus a judgment about capabilities. Why did the intelligence community present its judgments in this way? I hasten to emphasize I have absolutely no inside information or insight on this. I don't walk the corridors that I used to walk or pester old colleagues about what's going through their minds. But what I give you here is purely an experience-based speculation. I would be very chary of much of the commentary out there, which seems to just take it for granted, that the writers of this estimate had as their principal intention shaping the policy options according to their own policy preferences. Or to put it in a somewhat more ad hominem way that some of the commentary has taken, that this is a story of old State Department types who lost previous policy battles and now are using this vehicle to refight them. One reason I think you ought to be wary of that kind of assumption is that writing an intelligence product with this intent would be contrary to professional ethics and the sense of a professional officer's intelligence mission, and I am persuaded that the people who wrote this estimate have the same sense of professionalism and ethics that I just voiced. But a second consideration is that we ought to be careful about assuming how much the writers of a document like this could themselves assume or estimate about the impact that their public words would have. They are smart people who write these things, but they are not public relations specialists, they are not journalists, they are not professors, of politicians, who write, some professors do too, who write for the public, and so they cannot necessarily estimate what sort of impact their words would have had, and I think they can are smart enough to realize that.
Thank you very much. Leonard, please.
Thank you. First, let me just clarify my official title. I am the director of the Washington, D.C. office of the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, the home office based at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California, is led by Dr. William Potter, who is the director of the James Martin Nonproliferation Center. Avner, as he recruited us into this sort of academic speed dating experience we're having. I hope you'll all ask for my phone number afterwards. As he recruited us, he asked us to step away a little bit from the crisis du jour and to try to think about some of these issues at a higher level of generality and abstraction. So, Abner, I'm going to meet your challenge, and I know this is going to make great television. I want to discuss the epistemology of nonproliferation with you today in 7 minutes. Epistemology is the theory of knowledge and justified belief. And I think just to articulate that sentence, you can already anticipate what we're going to be talking about. How do we know what we know, and how can we be confident that what we know is solid and usable? And I think if we look back at a couple of historical examples, including the 2002-2003 Iraq episode and the current situation with Iran, we can really understand better how the intelligence process and the national intelligence estimates fit into our theory of knowledge and justified beliefs about what's unfolding in the case of proliferation. I think if we look back to the Iraq case, the information on which we all relied in one fashion or another, the data set was very small, and it came out of the intelligence community. And what we then did was we took a set of pre-existing beliefs and rational understandings, and we interpreted the data set in this with this other set of beliefs and understandings. And this, by the way, from what I've been reading in the last few days about epistemology, is a common theme in this whole notion of what do we understand. Is it based on external realities, or is it based on our rational, logical assessments of what's going on? In the Iraqi case, the intelligence data itself, as I say, just to repeat, was quite a small data set, as we all remember. And it was already challenged in part as it was being used to justify coerced inspections or the actual invasion. Al-Baradei had more or less, demonstrated that the Niger uranium documents were forgeries. And we also had, as the inspections unfolded on MOVIC, not finding anything on the nuclear side or the missile side, if I remember, and sort of working its way through nuclear and biological and chemical and not finding a whole lot either. So the data set, in a way, was shrinking in terms of what we were working with. But we coupled the rather small set of external facts with a very, very powerful set of pre-existing beliefs. And I want to just be clear, I had some of these. I shared many of them. Not everyone, but certainly many of them. We had the interpretive dimension of Saddam's previous weapon of mass destruction programs hidden from view. We had the free hand he was given once the UNSCOM inspectors were withdrawn from Iraq in 1998. We had Iraq's corruption of the oil for food program, which I think we all knew was ongoing at the time, which we also knew, among other things, put lots of cash into Saddam's hands, which apparently he spent on palaces rather than WMD, but we didn't know that. We knew that there was extensive smuggling, constant smuggling, going on across the Jordanian border and the Syrian border. We knew of Saddam's efforts to defeat UNSCOM inspections back when, and his reluctance, except with the threat of invasion, to allow any kind of new inspections to begin. And then we did have the Bush administration overlay, which I won't say I subscribe to, although some of the others I must say resonated. And that was the sense that Iraq was working with al-Qaeda and that there was this terrorism dimension. So just to repeat, small data set, lots of pre-existing viewpoints and understandings, some of them based, as David said, on the intelligence failure in 1991. But I think that was sort of the epistemology of the moment. That's how we understood what was unfolding. And I think these beliefs, pre-existing beliefs, turned out to be wrong as applied. And as I say, part of the problem was how we knew what we knew. We used a formula which wasn't what we want. But the Iranian situation is completely different. And here, we have a very strong data set. And we really do know things in a different way in terms of Iran's proliferative behavior. And the base is much more solid. And it's a situation in which intelligence and the national intelligence estimate play a much smaller role. We have feet on the ground. We've actually observed Natanz and Iraq and Esfahan and other locations. So we know the reality, at least in part, of what's going on and what we consider all of us consider to be the most dangerous part, the enrichment activities. We know that a civil program is underway that can lead to the production of fissile material down the road. and that it's a capability not justified by any kind of economic requirements in Iran. We have an undisputed history of clandestine activities. I mean, it's been acknowledged. We have the AQ Khan information. We have the contamination of centrifuge parts with HEU. So we know all of the kind of whole range of clandestine activities that occurred before. And this is beyond dispute. We don't need the intelligence community to tell us this now. We have that data. We have unambiguous evidence, I would say, that Iran is an anti-status quo power, which adds anxiety to what we observe. And that's a reasonable belief to bring to the table. Because of the work of Iran in the Middle East, especially in Lebanon and Gaza. And we then have, of course, just the added dimension of statements on the record by Iran's president, which are so inflammatory and so seeming to embrace the idea of a hostile, empowered Iran going after its enemies. You know, all of which, I think, creates a different environment for making judgments, a different epistemology. And I think in this setting, the NIE is sort of additive. It is a small increment in terms of what we, at least in the public, and I'd say even in Congress and elsewhere, understand about the problem. It is not the core of what we know, but simply, as I say, an additive element. It does help us to understand the period of clandestine activity that Iran engaged in was not just, as the Iranians claim, they didn't want their enrichment facilities bombed by Iraq or by anybody else during the preliminary period. We now can say, oh, well, the NIE tells us, the NIE tells us it was actually a clandestine program and we have, you know, we have intelligence estimates. Well, that's good. That adds in. But again, the fact of the clandestine activity has already been established. So I'd say in this case, we have a different balance. And I think we have a much sounder basis for taking action. There are, of course, pre-existing beliefs. But I think in this instance, it's a very small intellectual leap to say, here's the corpus of evidence, and I think it's a nuclear weapons program, if not an actual ongoing one at the moment, one that is waiting to occur. And that's certainly my personal position. And if it is a, and we contrast that with the situation in Iraq, where the leap of the intellectual leap that was required to take this little data set and make it into something was much, much greater. So in this context, the new national intelligence estimate forces us to recalibrate our inferences, but does not it doesn't undermine them. It just adjusts them a little bit. Maybe one increment of the nuclear weapons effort is stopped, but the core elements continue, and we have hard facts for that, unimpeachable evidence. And so I would say epistemology does most definitely have something to teach us. And I think what we need to do is kind of reinforce our appreciation of this so that as we try to make the case at the UN or wherever else that this is a distinct situation, this is not a replay of Iraq, we use the nature of the evidence as part of our argument, not just the actual facts themselves. I'd like to also make another point regarding uncertainty, just to shift gears a little bit. In all of these cases, we're going to be left with considerable uncertainty, and we need to bring an intellectual construct to that environment. In most instances, it will be wiser to kind of take the construct of, I won't call it worst casing, but in that direction, rather than assuming the best. And we can go back for many historical examples. Oh, that Brazilian program. Well, back when it might have just been civilian, but it might have been a weapons program. And then one day there was the shaft in Kashimbo that demonstrated there was a weapons interest. South Africa the same way. And many other cases where you had ambiguous evidence and you had to sort of lean in one direction or another as you design policy. Now, in the case of Iraq, we lean too far. I think we all appreciate that. But as we come to these other settings where we have ambiguity, I think we do well to craft policies that at least plan for the worst and try to avoid the worst rather than take a more benign vision. And I think, in fact, the administration is doing it, perhaps now tempered by having to take the nuclear option off the table. And I even think the other Security Council members and the rest are sort of also buying into this, that we have to fear the worst and try to keep the pressure on Iran. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank all of you very much, not least for sticking to time. It seems to me that all of these presentations underscore and remind us of the importance of proceeding cautiously in drawing policy implications from a document that is as complicated and in many respects as ambiguous as Iran, and I, even while stressing and focusing our attention on the difficulties of doing so, when a document like the NAIE is released into the kind of charged political context in which this one was made public. What I would like to do, we are a little bit over time, what I'd like to do is to extend just a few minutes to members of the panel to respond to your colleagues' comments, but really to do that in no more than 5 minutes, and then we'll open the floor to questions from the audience. So are there any of you who would like to make some of David, please.
Yeah, I want to respond to one thing that Jeffrey Lewis said, because I think it's the most important challenge the next administration really is going to have, although I disagree with the way Jeffrey put it. As I recall hearing it, the policymakers need to be disabused of their belief that they have the right to perfect intelligence. Let me tell you, that's about 180 degrees out from what this administration believes about the intelligence community. And it goes back, I know thanks to Bill Burr's efforts at National Security Archives, is consistent with what we know about the Nixon administration, well, actually Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Carter administration. That is, presidents and policymakers increasingly believe that the intelligence community never provides them anything that is correct or very useful. And therefore, you get a dialogue between the policymakers and the intel community that is toxic and not useful. I can speak with some authority with regard to the policymakers in the current administration. Their belief was that the information provided by the intelligence community was not useful and not accurate, and therefore their judgment was as good as, if not better than. Now, there are some things that relate to the particular peculiarities of administration, but there also are some generic things. If you look at the NIOs today, if you look at the average age and duration on the job of an intel analyst in the CIA and the DIA, you're talking about people that have less than 5 years' experience in their current job. And in most cases, for example, with regard to both Iran, which we're talking about today, and Iraq, have never spent any time in the country. You have a vice president who had been in both countries. You know, you have a lot of experience at the policymaker level, and because this has become such a toxic and untrusting belief and dialogue, of which I think this NIE, quite frankly, just compounds it, because it's a public document and a not very well done written public document, at least what got in the public domain, it increases this belief, there they go, they're off on their own. The next administration has, we've got to find a way to bring a balance and interject understanding of what intelligence can do, and it can never be perfect, you're absolutely right, and why it can't be perfect, and appreciation of it. On the same time, you've got to respect that policymakers have a right to make judgments. That's what they're elected. No one in the intel community has ever been elected for anything or is likely to be. So you need to bring that balance into the dialogue. And I would not just blame. I urge you to read history. This goes a long way back about administrations and their belief of the usefulness of the product of the intel community. A lot of it has to do with mass communication, for those of you who are journalists. The flow in which you get information from the field to your viewers is a hell of a lot quicker than most intel comes to the policymakers. It's just the nature of the world we live in, and we have not found a way to balance it.
Bill?
I should have said something in my compressed presentation. I left out an important point that would have been useful, because Henry Kissinger always complained about the NIE, saying they're too equivocal, they're too ambiguous. I want all the information I can make in my own mind. I want to be the intelligence officer who analyzes Soviet estimates or so forth. And that's, he was probably too harsh, but there was, he found that previous policymakers also were unhappy about the NIEs, that they weren't really quite what they wanted. They never were as good as they were supposed to be. So it's, this is an old problem, as you suggest.
Okay, not surprisingly, all of our panelists are something like, just a minute apiece, please, if you don't mind, Len and then Paul.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we may well have seen a change in 2003. This was, of course, on the heels of the invasion of Iraq, so it might have concentrated the mind in Iran, as well as the moderates really looking for this strategy that George described, which was a very thoughtful strategy that they may well have wanted to implement. But what happens in 2005, when you have Ahmadinejad now taking power and a kind of different stripe of player coming to the fore, who might not have been quite as sensitized to the nuances of international diplomacy and might have been prepared to take a more risky position. So I think the NIE leaves that door open as to exactly when, if there was a pause, the pause ended. And I think the domestic politics in Iran in that intervening period, 2005, 6, 7, it was worth factoring into an assessment.
In 1 minute, 3 points. One, it's not just policymakers, but all of us, the general public and the press, who seem to think we have a right to perfect intelligence. That is a chimera. We're never going to get it, which is related to point number two, that on this kind of topic in particular, but on many others as well, nuclear proliferation, you have a couple of inherent challenges. One, the secrecy of what our adversaries want to keep secret, and number two, I think Jeffrey Lewis emphasized this quite appropriately, the most important questions involve decisions yet to be taken. And unfortunately, we get into thinking about intelligence as some sort of prophecy business with a crystal ball. That's not what it is. And number three, related to both of those two, there is a tendency by us Americans to look to intelligence as a substitute for policy judgment. And we think that a particular intel judgment is going to give us the right policy answer. That's never going to happen, and certainly not on this issue, and certainly not how to deal with Iran.
Abner and then Jeff, you'll have the last word before we open up.
Yeah, I think that the sociology of intelligence community and the relation between the intelligence community and policymakers is terribly important to understand this document and the response to it within government, outside government. My own personal feeling was, when I read it, was almost like a document was prepared without intel supervision. And obviously, when you look at the government, I mean, government, after the fiasco in Iraq, feels very much reluctance to move into the business of the analyst. Now, what David said, I mean, we talk about analysts who are very, very young, and it's very easy, part of that sociology, to be fascinated by extremely classified hot stuff. And very often, in this case, whatever was this intercept or whatever they got from conversations of those people about various hope. I mean, there is no any, at least in the classical version, effort to explain the meaning of that, its strategic meaning, was it a strategic decision, smaller decision, and also perhaps, sometimes communication between people who do weaponization and people who do the fission material. I mean, the job was done as far as the people who do weaponization as long as they don't have the stuff, so they're waiting. So technically, you need to put them on hold because there is no yet fission material. And it seems that all these considerations, which may or may not have impact, were not even counted into the document because somebody was very fascinated by this discovery.
Well, I just wanted to sort of reemphasize that no one's mentioned the sort of Team D experience in the 1970s, nor the Rumsfeld Commission on Ballistic Missile Proliferation in the 1990s. And I think that both of those experiences underscore a degree to which sometimes give me something I can use really means tell me what I want to hear. And so, particularly on this NIE, I noticed that Senator Ensign was talking about a Rumsfeld-like commission for it within a matter of a day of it being out. And I strongly doubt that he had time to read, all 150 pages or whatever it was before he proposed that. So that word of caution.
Thank you. We have microphones on either side of the floor. What I would ask is that people with questions or short comments line up behind the microphones, and that when you ask your question, you identify yourself and please direct it to a member of the panel, unless you'd like the panel in general to respond. Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
Thank you for identifying me. This question is for Paul. I would assume that those who wrote this NIE also did not anticipate the impact that it would have on Iran. And I don't know if you would like to comment or others would like to comment just briefly. My impression is that the NIE has been enormously helpful in terms of opening up the debate in Iran over the nuclear program, over the economic situation in particular. We've seen that Iranians who are all engaged in running for parliament in March are now taking pot shots against Ahmadinejad in a way that they perhaps not might not have done before. They seem to have felt somewhat liberated by the NIE and the sense that this indeed would remove the military option from the table. Any sense in which those who wrote this NIE would have calculated at all what the impact would be on Iran domestically?
There are two possible contradictory ways in which this could work politically in Iran. One would be that Iran and the current regime, feeling under less pressure, would in fact be more assertive with regard to nuclear activities and so on. The other is the one that you voiced, Barbara, with which I on balance agree, that I think it has had that beneficial effect of by taking away the immediate perceived threat insofar as they perceived it of a clash with the United States, exercise of the military option, more attention is focused on the shortcomings of the regime. Nonetheless, the fact that we can still debate about this, and there are some people who disagree with the view that you expressed and with which I just agreed, means it would have been very hard to project in advance or to game out, the particular Iranian response. And I think the writers of this estimate were smart enough to realize that they would not be able to do that accurately. So, I don't think they probably had that in mind. But let me just add, I do not discount as a qualification what I said before, that the writers of this estimate had at least in the backs of their minds the effect of taking the military option off the table. And if they did, we should not be surprised, given the recent and sordid history of the whole unhappy Iraq unconventional weapons story, in which the intelligence community was pilloried, not just for what it got wrong, but even on things that it got right, either by enabling, as it was charged, enabling this war to be sold because it did not protest loudly enough when the administration ran with a particular erroneous line, like the business about the Nigerian uranium ore, or provided tidbits that could be built into a tale that contradicted the intelligence community's own assessments, as with the terrorist connection business. And if that's the case, and I'm just speculating here, but if that was in the backs of their minds, we can consider that one of the prices to pay for vilification of the intelligence community for responsibility for a war decision that was taken not because of, but in spite of its judgments about Iraq.
Diane Perlman, I'm a social scientist studying dynamics of cycles of violence. And this is for Leonard mostly. And it also relates to Barbara's comment, which highlights sort of the dynamic interaction between our actions and Iranian response. So in terms of epistemology and how we know what we know, I guess I'd add another dimension to that, which I call like the political Heisenberg principle, which is the effect of the observer, that the effect of us, of our actions on what we're observing, instead of saying they're doing this and they're doing that, and considering the effect of our actions, say, after they helped us with intelligence after 2001, that we rejected their offer in 2003, and say, the counterfactual, like what might have happened if we would have accepted that, but also that people are more dangerous when they're afraid and when they're threatened, and we're also more dangerous when we're afraid and we're threatened. So I'd like to suggest maybe a psychological intelligence estimate to add a dimension to this. And you talked about, you know, whether we should prepare for the best case, the worst case scenario or the best case scenario, and maybe we could have an attitude that we could, what can we do to create the that our role in increasing the best case scenario and creating intended consequences by tuning into the dynamics.
Well, I don't want to continue in the world of epistemology much further because I'm not going to be well over my head. I think we are at a moment right now when there may be something afoot that will enable us to work with Iran more effectively. There was the right at the time of the NIE coming out, which I think created a sort of gentler environment between the two countries. There were the statements by the senior White House and the State Department officials that the Iranians had apparently directed the Shiite militias in Iraq to pull back on roadside bombings and some of the other violence. So it may be that the other side, at least, and now kind of, I think, through inadvertence, not deliberately to match this, we, through the NIE, have maybe created a setting in which some real dialogue could take place. I think we should be probing for that and seeing if we can exploit it.
Other jump in on that? Sir.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. I've got a very brief question for Mr. David Kay. Since with his experience, he can say that has Saddam Hussein had the nuclear program, ongoing nuclear program, and how was the contribution of the Pakistani nuclear scientist, I would say the marketing man, Mr. A.Q. Khan? And then, was it accepted, or this offer was not accepted? If it was not, was Mr. A.Q. Khan did pass on the same information to Iran, and what has been the contribution of Mr. A.Q. Khan to Iran?
Well, with regard to the Pakistani offer, the A.Q. Khan offer to Iraq, the judgment we reached, and is confirmed, it has been confirmed earlier by UNSCOM and OMAVIC, was that, in fact, the Iraqis rebuffed it. I have had opportunities through discussions with the senior Iraqi officials involved, and it's interesting. They probably should have accepted. But it was a case of cultural judgments. As put to me by a senior Iraqi atomic energy official, we didn't think the Pakistanis could do anything better than we could. And, you know, it was a case of arrogance, scientific and intellectual arrogance felt by Iraqis about Pakistanis. In some sense, Sunni, Shia divisions yet again. So all the evidence is they did not pick up the offer. A.Q. Khan offered, if you can judge by what was on offer, is very much the same thing that he apparently had as his standard marketing package, as you referred to it. We can help you with enrichment. We can help you with a basic weapons design. We can provide you access to a network of suppliers who will help you to do that. Well, network of suppliers the Iraqis already had. They didn't need help on it. And it was a matter of scientific arrogance, particularly of Jafar Diyajafar, who thought, God, Khan's an engineer. I'm a physicist. What help can an engineer provide me? I mean, it's you have to know a physicist to understand this. It's not meant as a slam on Iraqi physicists. A physicist is any guy who can walk in your lab, regardless of the domain, and tell you in 10 minutes later how to do it better. And that was very typical of the Iraqi scientific establishment. I think the UN, IAEA, has Sandy mentioned this, has documented rather thoroughly, although I echo what George said, I wish the IAEA had pressed harder on all of this with regard to what was on offer, but it was the standard package. Uranium enrichment, design of centrifuges, and access to supplier networks, and a weapons design that looks like the Chinese weapons design that was initially provided to the Pakistanis as a first generation. So that's it. With regard to what Saddam had ongoing in his nuclear program at the time of the 2003 invasion, which was one of your questions, look, there was the nuclear capacity, nuclear research capacity of the Iraqis in 2003 was anywhere close to what it had been in 1990, 1991. It had been taken down to a very low level. There were some efforts to
having realized that, to do some research on importation of equipment and all, it was nowhere there. My judgment is, although Saddam, I listened to the 60-minute interview, which was, the PR was, it's the best thing the FBI has done in 100 years. God, it frightens me about the FBI. But if, you know, the conclusion that Saddam wanted this restart his WMD program, I think is absolutely accurate. But what was not said is the general capacity to produce weapons of mass destruction had been largely destroyed by the cycle of corruption and the policies of Saddam's government, as well as the UN inspectors, in the period from 1991 to 2003. We did not recognize how much harm Saddam had done to his own society, including his scientific capability. He may have wanted it, but even if sanctions had come off, it would have been a very long process before, in the nuclear area, he could have reestablished it. Bathtub chemistry is something else.
Hi, I'm Ellie Staples with CQ. I was wondering, several years ago when the debate was what WMD Iraq might have, it seemed that biological and chemical weapons were discussed more. I'm wondering why that isn't the case with Iran, when some experts believe that a biological weapon, you know, could be almost as dangerous as a nuclear one. Is that just because the writers of the NIE weren't asked to discuss those weapons, and, you know, should they be more of a concern, or is it just sort of hard to know what their capabilities are with those particular WMD? And that's just for anyone.
We have actually, one of our colleagues at the Monterey has just written a short piece on the changing evaluations of the chemical weapons capabilities of Iran. It's sort of an interesting parallel, which really hasn't gotten much attention. If you go back and trace the NIEs of, or analyses or statements by the various intelligence officials to the Congress and some of the annual reports that are filed, 4 or 5 years ago, it was asserted that Iran had a stockpile of chemical weapons, the first generation weapons, mustard, and some of the other early agents, and was working on the nerve agents. And then as the as you watch the evolution of some of these statements, as he says in the title of the article, the older chemical weapons seem to evaporate because they're no longer mentioned and there's no longer confidence that they exist. And I think this parallels the retreat, or let me say it differently, it parallels the greater caution the administration showed and the intelligence community showed in evaluating biological capabilities of Cuba, and then most recently the nuclear capabilities in Iran. So there is, I don't think there was an NIE on the topic, but there was a commentary on it that one can see an evolution on the part of the IC.
This particular document had the scope it did because the intelligence community was responding to a congressional request to write on this topic, evidently because that's the front burner issue, the nuclear question. And it's an occasion to remind us, remind everyone that national intelligence estimates are only one art form that constitute a tiny proportion of the total analytic output of the intelligence community. I think we can be confident that, in addition to what Sandy said, ample attention has been paid to those other unconventional weapons topics regarding Iran.
My name is Faribos Frank Fulati. I have a company called Procurement USA Inc. I procure for the government of people, of the government of the people, for the people. And the way you're describing, I understand we don't want lose nuclear bombs in the market. We know that Iran has, as Dr. Rice said, many states within the state. Now that I'm listening to you, in order to, I'm a peace seeker and also a human rights activist, it's good for the business. I was wondering that what is your option, what is your opinion for President Bush so we can work this peacefully with Iran?
To anyone in particular?
Anyone.
I think if we were to reframe that question in terms of whether the NIE, in fact, opens up opportunities for moving the approach of the Bush administration toward Iran in a different direction, first, do those possibilities exist, and second, under what conditions might they be pursued?
Let me just start very quickly. I actually think the NIE and the way it was presented makes it less likely and harder. The reaction to the NIE, including my own, the criticism of it as a document, and the general criticism of it, particularly from our European and other allies, has made it difficult both with regard to continuing the sanctions, but even more difficult to open up the sort of dialogue that I think is necessary. I mean, my counterfactual, if I were to do a counterfactual, would be, what if the intel community had come to the policymakers with this, the one new piece of judgment about a part of a clandestine program or a whole clandestine program, however you want to define it, had been shut down, would some policymaker have been picked up and said, okay, there's an opportunity now, let's try to be open to discussions, while at the same time maintaining an attitude that they have to give up enrichment? I think there would probably be a greater chance. I sort of feel that what has been done, as in so many issues of U.S. policy, is being kicked to the next administration. This administration is just not going to pick it up and do it. Let me say, I personally think if you read the NIE, there's a lot in there that gives you margin of action that is far greater than just military action. The NIE judgment falls right. It's generally consistent with the earlier one with regard to how long it will take to acquire enough fissionable product for weapons, multiple weapons. I mean, there's a lot going on there that gives you time to carry on diplomatic discussions and other efforts. I just don't see anything this administration is likely to pick it up. But I'm a pessimist on this one.
Well, I don't know about this administration, but at least from a sort of the argument that I would make about what our policy ought to be in light of the NIE, is that I generally agree with the sense that the Iranians still have programs that we have a right to be concerned about, and the question is, on what basis do you negotiate, and what kind of outcome do you see? And at least in terms of the basis for negotiation, I have long thought that the administration would go further if taking the sort of requirement that Iran suspend its activities as a condition for negotiations. Suspend is one of these words with no technical meaning, and I would sort of interpret that liberally to include sort of warm standby options where the centrifuges spin, but they just don't feed feedstock. And in terms of a final outcome, I have argued, and it's not a very popular argument around Washington, so I guess I'm pessimistic about it. But ultimately, I think we have to start thinking about the rate at which we would trade accepting certain amounts of fuel cycle activity in Iran for extraordinary monitoring measures. It seems to me that at some level it's impossible to get Iran to walk back to zero indefinitely. And so the question is, how much information do we need to have on a regular basis to feel confident that we have policy options if the bomb option sort of starts to tend toward a bomb? I can at least see. I certainly agree that there is a sort of short-term cost of the NIE in terms of the collapse in support for pressure, but I do see sort of two potential benefits from it. I mean, the first is there is this reduction of pressure which does potentially alter the political situation in Iran, and that's not a reason to write an NIE or to release it, but it's not clear to me that a more hostile international environment would actually produce a more compliant Iranian regime. And the second is, I think the NIE, by identifying certain activities as a weapons program that was halted, provides a sort of path for them to come clean. I mean, there's one of the big concerns I'd had is that any deal with Iran would require the Iranians to admit doing things that could immediately be used against them. In some ways, I think there's a potential for policymakers to use the NIE as a sort of fig leaf that says, well, yeah, we knew you did this bad stuff, but we knew that all along, and the fact that you've stopped it is what is important.
Yeah, I would add just two things. For Iran to come clean, it's only complicated situation. That means not only they cheated almost 20 years ago, but they cheated 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. So you try to make them clean, but as you do them clean, there is more dirt that's coming out. So there is problems there. The other issue is indeed, there are two Security Council resolutions which talk about suspensions. You're right that if you do some creative diplomacy, you can rename and re-grant meaning to the notion of suspensions. but it's difficult once you have on the table those claims. It's difficult to go another channel that you put aside those call for suspension. So that's the problem.
Sir. Hi, my name is David Poplack from the Fund for Peace. I think actually Jeff just answered a large part of my question, so I will kind of defer the put a little bit more emphasis on the second part, which I think is to Mr. Burr mostly. In an article that George wrote shortly after the declassified portion of the NIE came out, he suggested that essentially, I think it was George, that essentially Iran's nuclear activities are inevitable. Inevitably they will obtain enough fissile material to construct a bomb, if not an arsenal, that there will be some sort of gradual depletion of the power of the NPT. And I'm wondering if the NIE or if other... It seems that this NIE in particular and on Iraq also are very technologically sort of focused, and I'm wondering if there's still an aspect of intelligence assessment that's largely based in what the woman over there had suggested was more psychological in the motivations of the Iranian leadership. And maybe that falls into the sort of black box of the future, but... I was wondering sort of if there's been a gradual shift towards this purely technological means, or if that's part of what Mr. Pillar suggested was just a portion of the assessments that actually come out of the intelligence community. Thanks.
I think I'm not suited to answer that question. Well, maybe Pillar might be.
Well, don't hinge everything on what you saw on this unclassified key judgments from this estimate. Yes, the intelligence community is occasionally asked, and even when they're not asked, well, not just occasionally, but often addresses precisely those sorts of motive questions. They tend to be ones on which the intelligence community does not have all that much comparative advantage over outside experts who are reading the public statements and have something based on expertise to say about the probable motivations of Iran. So there are lots of valid things to be said, and some of them are said in classified documents about likely motivations and what this means in terms of possible compromises per what was said in response to the previous question. But in the end, it is mostly a matter of decisions yet to be taken. That's something where no one person's or agency's crystal ball tends to be any better than anyone else's.
My name is Adel Shirkaw from Al Hurra TV. I have two quick questions. The first one, the NIE mentions that Iran stopped its clandestine program in the fall of 2003, which was the same time when the then president, Iranian President Mohammad Khatami, extended the offer to the U.S. to discuss the nuclear program, the relationship between Iran and Hezbollah and all the other groups. And my question here is, did the Bush administration miscalculate the real intentions of the Iranian president then? And the second question is, as Mr. Perkovich said, if this is a strategic choice by the Iranians to stop or to stick to the letter to the NPT and keep the enrichment program, what is the best the strategic choice for the U.S. to counterbalance that instead of just weaker UN resolutions, as he said, without resolutions without teeth?
It would be hard to say that the U.S. miscalculated the intentions of the president when the Secretary of State has said she doesn't even remember the 2003 so-called Zurich memo. So you can't miscalculate something you never observed took place. I mean, that's one of the ironies of that particular. I leave that to diplomatic historians who are going to have a field day on that sort of issue.
Well, there certainly have been missed opportunities going back through the whole Khatami era. It's not just this 2003 thing. I wouldn't focus on that. There have been other points at which opportunities have been missed.
At this point, why don't I invite Avner to offer whatever kind of final comments would be appropriate just to get us wrapped up. Let me again thank all of our panelists for taking part. Thank you for joining us. I'd also like to thank Christopher New, the program assistant who really did all the heavy lifting and making sure you all arrived here today. Ebner, some final thoughts on this?
Well, I appreciate you coming here. I thought it was a very interesting discussion. I think there are so many faces to this document that require thinking and further thinking. It is amazing that one document could create that much intended and unintended consequences of all sorts, from the most academic and abstract to the very much concrete and various kind of capitals of the world. One thought that comes to my mind is the general questions of the relation between the classified world of intelligence and the world of policy and the public at large. My own view is, the more I think about it, is either we keep the documents sealed and classified as it was in the tradition in the past. I do not advocate it, but I think it will prevent some of the confusion and some of the misleading and some of the fallout that in this case was unnecessary, that one branch of government called independence and rebellion perhaps against the rest of the government. Very, very strange situation. Or perhaps the other position, which I do advocate, to have a much major open document that accepts, you know, sources and methods, keeps most of the reasons. For example, the question of the halting, what was there? Strategic, tactical, what do we know about it? How do we assess it? What was the role in the because then there is so many questions that we have, and as a result would criticize the writers, I think should be much more open, because the issue is so much on the mind of this public policy debate. So I think the compromise to have only 2.5 pages plus a few pages of explanation in annotated fashion to explain what is high confidence and mid confidence and so forth is perhaps not the best. And perhaps, I think this time, if I'm not correct, was mandated by Congress to have some version which would be unclassified. Maybe the better way is to have a real document, maybe 30, 40, I mean the document I understand was about 150 pages, but a major document that could be criticized and critiqued in a serious way. I'm thinking we are in some way handicapped by this criticism because we don't really know what was there. We all pick up the first sentence, which was terrible. We look at the analysts who wrote it and we are surprised that they wrote such documents, but we have no idea what was there. So maybe that compromise is the wrong one, and we should have much more in the open. So that's my general thought.
Something to consider. Thank you all very much, and thanks to our panel.
Oh, 1400.